This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey everyone, this is Boomer Esiason, and welcome to another edition of our Game Time podcast. No less an authority on special teams play than Bill Belichick has hailed today's guest as, quote, as good as a punter as the NFL has seen. Now, the hoodie was referring to fourth down diamond Thomas Morstead of the Miami Dolphins. Thomas, welcome to our Game Time podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Thomas, during Miami's bye week, you returned to New Orleans, where you formerly played and certainly still have your home there. While your coaches warned the players about having a night on the town, what you did hardly was the kind of night that they envisioned. Please tell our podcast audience, what is voluntary suffering and what did you do?
Okay, so there's an organization called Covenant House. There's locations all over the country, but there's one right outside the French Quarter in New Orleans, and they provide a place to stay, a lot of resources, therapy, mental health. They get people on their feet. They get them job training. And it's just an organization that we've felt like, you know, I know everyone has different faith backgrounds. We just feel like they're doing God's work, and we've tried to support them for a number of years. And it just so happened that it fell on the bye week this year, and they'd asked if I would sleep out to help bring some attention to it. And, you know, if you're a player in the NFL and you do this on a Thursday before a Sunday and you don't play well, that's a really bad look. So I've never done it before, but because it was on the bye week, I agreed to do it. And it was really a great experience. I brought my two boys with me that are 8 and 7 years old, and we had a cold front hit that night, and it was really good. It spurred a lot of good questions from them. And I explained to them that, you know, not everybody gets to sleep in a nice, cozy, warm bed at night. And we all did it together. And they were great. They were champs. They didn't complain about it. And hopefully it's an experience that'll leave an impact on them to provide a little perspective on how good their life is.
Yeah, you know, they actually have that sleep out here in New York. And I know the GM of the New York Yankees, Brian Cashman, much like you down there in New Orleans, is a big part of that. And he says it's more enlightening to him each and every year, the plight of the homeless in our country.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can't even really replicate it, because guess what? At the end of the day, the next day I'm going home, and I get to sleep in my bed that night. And then the other side of it is, you know, they've got it secured off, because people are probably not going to sign up to do this fundraiser if they're in true danger. And so that's something you can't replicate either, is you got a police, you know, that are circling you, that, you know, you're safe and you can sleep safely. It's just more of a physical suffering of just, you know, it's cold outside, it's uncomfortable, all those types of things. So it really is hard to replicate the true feeling of homelessness, because a lot of times it's perpetual. You have no idea when it's going to end or if it will ever end. And you also don't, you just have this feeling of it's just very stressful in every way imaginable. And so just to provide a little bit of insight and get people to be aware of it, you know, hopefully that does some good.
You know, I can tell you that you're very thoughtful and that you're thought out, and certainly appreciate where you come from. And, you know, I've read where you said that you actually play with a chip on your shoulder, and most punters, you don't think that would be the case. Where did that actually come from, and how does that help?
I think, like a lot of great players, you have challenges early that you're well supported through that harden you a little bit to you know, the realities of the, you know, the job or life or, you know, I mean, you've been in NFL locker rooms. You've played. Think about it. There's so many teammates that you know that they statistically they shouldn't be here for X, Y, or Z reason. And you know, my story is different, just like your story is different. Everybody's is different. But I was fortunate to be very well supported through some kind of hard times as a young person. And as a professional, I really had about as smooth a ride as you can have. I mean, there's been a little bit of tough stuff the past year when I got released from the Saints, but, you know, I think that really built me. And, like I said, I was just very fortunate to have a stable upbringing, parents that have been there every step of the way. But I think deep down there's, you don't know people that have that grit. A lot of times kids nowadays don't have, they don't have to show it because they haven't had to go, maybe they haven't had to go through something to even know that it's there. And I think some people just have something inside of them that, they're not, that, you know, they're just not going to be agreeable to, being told how it's going to be. They're going to make things happen and they want to dictate the way their life's going to go. And I certainly feel like I have some of that. I think that's, probably some of that comes from my parents and just the way I was raised.
You know, most players try to calm themselves down, Thomas, and mentally and physically, you've said that you actually do the opposite and try to create what I thought is really interesting, artificial adrenaline. It seems a bit counterintuitive to me a little bit, but can you explain what that means?
Yeah. you know, I think you think of kickers, a lot of them, you think of having ice in their veins, right? They have no pulse. They're just steady. And I think there's something to that as far as your mental side of your clarity and your calmness and confidence in big moments. But for me, I am I need that fight or flight feeling. You know, I need that dog chasing after you that's trying to come bite you at your heels. Like, I'm looking to try to create that because I've realized for me that when I have that fight or flight feeling, my body's going to do something that it otherwise wouldn't be able to do. So, for instance, if, you know, when I used to kick off, if I would normally hit a 70-yard kickoff in practice, in the game it was 77, 78. It's there's different juices flowing. Your body's preparing to do something different. And so for me, once I realized that that anxiety, that sick feeling, that nausea of game day jitters was my body preparing to do something special that I otherwise couldn't do on a practice field, I was like, man, how can I find this drug that allows me to do this? And some of that's with breathing techniques. Honestly, I carry this little book of pictures of people that stir me up emotionally, mainly in positive ways, you know, a grandparent, somebody that's invested in me, my wife, my kids, my parents, things like that, that I can look at and just see those people and they're watching and get you an emotional charge. And every now and then you need that. It's hard to come out on fire every single day, every single game, you know, especially when you get in the middle of the season. And so I've found ways to kind of keep myself, you know, to provide that for myself. And it's probably not the norm, but a lot of the ways I operate are a little unorthodox, but they work for me.
I was going to say, you had the picture of Coach Gans in your Super Bowl locker, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
That was a big one. I mean, like I said, he passed away the day after I got drafted, and he was such a godsend mentor for me as a 22-year-old kid in college that's looking for some, you know, somebody to show me the way. I mean, he never once taught me how to punt a football. He taught me how to live my life, how to love your family, and how to you know, value the things that are important. And he didn't tell me. I just watched him do it. And it was such a great mentor for me at that time in my life. And I certainly feel like I'm kind of like his last pupil. And, you know, the people that that all played for Frank or worked with him, it's kind of a cool fraternity of people that all knew him. So.
You know, you talk about mentors. You play with Drew Brees for 12 years, and you said that the future Hall of Famer taught you the importance of focusing on controlling what you can control. He's also talked to you about his experience with regard to retirement. You're 36 now. When do you think you'll know that the train has stopped, and have you started planning for your next act? And if so, will it be football-related?
I don't know what it's going to be. I've had a few people tell me they think I would potentially – have a knack for being an analyst. I don't know that that's something I would love to do, but the few people that I know that I've talked to that have done that have said they didn't think that's what they wanted to do, and they've ended up being very good at it. So I'm not sure. I'm not letting myself go down that road. This game is awesome, and there's nothing like it. And I know that I'll have time to figure it out when I'm done. And I've, you know, been very fortunate. I've made a lot of money in this league and saved a lot and invested a lot. So I'm not in any sort of financial position to have to do anything. So all I know is this, is I don't want to have a regret when I'm done playing. And I know that I still love doing everything that it takes to be the best at this game. I love the training. I love the grind. I love being counted on by my teammates. And you know as well as anybody, there's nothing like that locker room. And as long as I still love doing it and love all the aspects to doing it, and my family supporting me in doing it, you know, I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can. I love it. And that's as simple as I can put it.
All right, we're continuing our podcast conversation with Thomas Morstead of the Miami Dolphins. Now, Thomas, let's focus in on this current season. After a dozen years in New Orleans, which we'll get into a little bit later on, and after brief stops with both the Jets and the Falcons last year, you signed in Miami. So why did you choose to sign with the Dolphins, and are you enjoying your first season in South Florida?
There's a multitude of reasons I joined. You know, number one, I thought the team had a shot to be pretty good. And it was that prospect was exciting. You know, there's a lot of old people that moved down to Florida. And as far as the NFL goes, I'm kind of getting into that range. And thought it'd be nice to have some warm weather practices into December. So, and, you know, my kids were fired up about being close to the beach and maybe being able to do some fishing and some cool activities that we don't live near the beach in New Orleans. So, just lots of different things that all added up, and you know, the Dolphins didn't have a punter on the roster when I reached out to see what was going on, and you know, just made it clear that I was, you know, I wasn't too worried about the financial piece. I just needed a commitment from them that showed me that they were excited about having me, and so, you know, it all worked out, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, they got a hell of a punter, high praise from Coach Belichick for sure. Now, your new rookie head coach, Mike McDaniel, has been a breath of fresh air for the NFL. And, I mean, it's amazing. He's turning around the fortunes of the franchise. He's made Tua into an all-pro quarterback. But he's only about 3 years older than you. And I'm just thinking, that's got to be pretty weird, you know, playing for a coach that young. And how does he compare with the great Sean Payton?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. I think it'd be a disservice to make any comparison to Coach Payton. You know, he's obviously an offensive-minded guy. He's got a head coaching job in his late 30s, kind of like Coach Payton did in New Orleans. So I see a lot of similarities there. And he's having some good success, and we are as a team, in his first year. So there's a lot of unique things that they kind of probably – you can see the correlation. But I hate comparing the two. I didn't even know Coach Payton whenever he was in his first 3 years, and I was a rookie where I had blinders on in 2009, and I'm unaware of any of the dynamics of how that works. So I kind of know more of Coach Payton in his later years pretty well. But all I know is this: it's good to be asked that, you know, if you're Mike McDaniel, to be compared to somebody like him who's had so much success. And I've really enjoyed playing for him. You know, he is a rookie in a sense because he's a first-year head coach, but he's got some unique ways of dealing with players. He's kind of vulnerable in his own way, which is kind of, you know, counter to the tough guy football coach that you kind of have seen historically. And and I think guys have enjoyed that. And you know, I don't think he has much of an ego, which is pretty cool. And you know, I told my wife the other day, I said, it feels like I'm one of my buddies from college is coaching this team. So you can definitely tell he's from my generation. And the best thing I could say about him is he's just authentic. He's himself. And I think when you are authentic, guys respect that in the locker room. And at the end of the day, all everybody's concerned about is winning. And if you're winning, things are good.
You know, Thomas, I think you said the right thing. Authentic is the key word. Now, I got to ask you about something that happened to you this year, and this was in Week 10 versus the Cleveland Browns. You guys win 39-17. Tua Tagovailoa and that offense was so efficient, you didn't have to punt once in that game. And I'm just wondering, like, did you get bored during the game? Or, you know, what were you doing during the game? Kicking in the net over there by yourself? I'm just trying to wonder, what does a punter do in that situation?
Sure. Look, I think I'm unorthodox in a lot of ways. Number one, I don't punt into the net ever. So I don't even use the net. I just have a series of drills that I do to stay active and stay loose and that. I would say it's a more of an anxious game for me the longer it goes without playing. And I'm doing more. I'm actually more tired and more exhausted at the end of the game because I'm kind of – the best way to make an analogy is kind of like you're getting ready to be dropped off the edge of a bridge with a bungee cord for your first play. You know, there's an anxiety, there's nerves, there's adrenaline, but you don't know when that play is coming and you don't know if it'll ever come. And just being ready for that, but not knowing when it's going to happen, that just continues to build and build and build as the game goes. So fortunately for me, I've got a lot of experience with that. I think I've had 7 or 8 no punt games in New Orleans with Drew and Coach Payton. So it's taught me how to stay locked in and stay ready, regardless if I've had any actual gameplay in the game.
You know, when I was reading up on you, and obviously I followed you covering the NFL since you've been a punter down there in New Orleans, you said rather than building on the previous year's success, each year you like to start over and relearn all the technical aspects of punting and kicking the football. So how does that process actually work?
You know, I'm a little bit sentimental. You know, I'm living the most amazing dream that any kid could imagine. And I like to go back to where it all started. So there's a park that's right next to our house in New Orleans. There's no lines on it. I don't bring a stopwatch out. And I just go out with the kids and I start punting in March. And I just focus on hitting spirals. It's kind of like going out to the driving range and just hitting balls. And I don't like to measure myself on the football field until a coach has a stopwatch at minicamp or at OTAs. And I just try to keep it pure. You know, sometimes the lines can deceive a player. And, you know, being that I'm an older player and I don't have the 65-yard, 5.3-second hang time punts that maybe I used to hit, being a directional guy is how I survive and compete at a high level. And so getting out onto a field with no lines and just punting at trees or flagpoles, and, you know, we get the neighborhood kids out there that think it'd be kind of cool to catch punts for me. And I just do that to start off. And so I take a pretty good chunk of time off in the off season from punting, but I'm kind of a gym rat. I don't really take a break from the season. Like when the season's over, I'm actually kind of ready to get back into a full go lifting and training how I like to train. So that's where I measure my, my progress is in the gym.
Yeah, and I know you're a 24/7 athlete. We'll get into that as well. We're just getting warmed up with the great Thomas Morstead. In a moment, he's going to tell us how getting cut from his high school soccer team ultimately led to becoming an NFL All-Pro punter. Welcome back to Game Time, everyone. During a summer visit to England, where his mother is from, one of Thomas Morstead's uncles taught the young lad how to drop kick a rugby ball. And lo and behold, exclaimed Uncle Charles, Tom was kicking it like merry hell. Now, your natural affinity for kicking led you to take up soccer at Parolin High School just south of Houston. So were you crushed when you were unexpectedly cut your senior year?
Yeah, it was actually my junior year. It was the worst day of my life to that point. I remember just scanning through the list. I couldn't believe my name wasn't. I was like, I'm not seeing it somewhere here. And so that actually what got me to. My mom said, you know, you really should try out for the football team and go out and try to have a good senior year experience because soccer seemed kind of, you know, like it wasn't going to be an option. And my high school town of Pearland's kind of one of these places where all the stores, you know, they shut down, the signs in the window saying be back after the game. And so I just went out and gave it a shot. And I took over all the jobs as my senior year went along. And, you know, I thought that was it whenever the season ended. And the week after the season ended, I got pulled out of class three times by my coach because there were different recruiters in to visit and figure out, you know, trying to find players. And he was not a BSer. He said, look, you have never lifted weights. You have no polish, but you do things that I haven't seen a high school kid do. Technically, I think if you decided you wanted to commit to doing it, you really could have a chance to play in college. And so once that light bulb went off for me, I started, you know, to lift weights and just kind of made a commitment. I thought it'd be a cool thing to play on a Saturday one day. And I was a walk-on player at SMU for 2 years, tryout first day of school guy. And fortunately at SMU at the time, they really struggled to field enough walk-ons. And I was already accepted in. I got an engineering scholarship to go to SMU. And so they didn't have to do any work to get me in. I was already in. So they were happy to have me. And I knew, you know, they had a junior and two juniors that were punter and kicker starters. So I knew I had 2 years to kind of, develop and work on myself. And, so it was a perfect situation for me.
I'm just wondering if the drop kicking skill ever helped you out or in any way.
It certainly did. I actually, in my third semester at SMU, I was kind of disgruntled, didn't feel like I was getting an opportunity. And my strength coach, Chuck Fawcett, pulled me aside and said, listen, kid, we've got the bye week this week, and they're going to let some younger guys get some reps in practice. He said, none of the coaches know your name, which is a good thing because you're a punter and you're a walk-on, but you need to make sure they know who you are at the end of this week. And so I went out and started warming up early, and I, long story short, made a bet with our defensive coordinator that I could hit a drop kick. And he said, well, if you hit it from the Mustang, which is on the 50-yard line, 60-yard drop kick field goal, I'll get you a rep in practice. And it was just kind of fate. I mashed it. And I turned around and I just said, I hope you're a man of your word. And I walked off and they put me in that day. I made 3 for 3 on field goals. And they said, wow, we didn't know you were a field goal kicker. I said, I'm not, I'm a punter. You should let me punt today. And I punted. And 3 weeks later, I was on full ride scholarship.
So. Oh, that is awesome. By the way, you and I have something in common. Your boy, Chucky Fawcett, Chucky Fred, was my teammate at the University of Maryland back in the day.
No way, Terrapin.
Yes.
There you go. That's right.
How about Very that? Cool. Yes. Okay, so here, speaking of drop kicks, do you ever want to try one like Doug Flutie did on the last play of his career?
Listen, I'll tell you, I remember when he did that, I thought that is really cool that he did that. And I know Bill Belichick's a huge fan of the history of the game and loves special teams. And so that was really cool that he got to do that. I did have some real envy when Drew got to try it at the Pro Bowl and he missed. They let Drew Brees try it at the Pro Bowl, and I remember being very envious of that. I would love to have had that shot to do it. So
now listen, I got to get to this. Your dad was a big-time cyclist. I didn't realize this. And how many Tour de France's did he ride in?
He never rode in any of the tours of France, Italy, or any of those big European tours. He was a 6-time state champion in 3 different states as a kind of a 20s and 30-year-old rider, and he was at national championships for 13 consecutive years in the U.S. And it was really cool for me growing up. You know, everybody thinks their dad's so cool, and you know they have pride in their dad, but. I saw my dad, you know, I saw him do things and compete against kids that were younger than him when he was in his mid 30s, still racing really well. And it was such a cool experience for me and to watch him. And that sport is all about suffering. And so I saw my dad be a great model of how to be a professional. And I take a lot of pride in that for sure.
You know, it's kind of like you are right now playing with those younger kids. You know, the Saints traded up to get you in the 5th round of the 2009 draft. So what was your reaction when GM Mickey Loomis called to tell you the news that you had been drafted by the Saints?
I was in total tears. You know, there's so much uncertainty about whether you could get drafted or not. And I just remember just breaking down into tears because we're from Houston and I just remember my mom shrieking, you know, 5 hours down I-10, you know, like it, other than being a Texan or being a cowboy, it was as close as I could be to home. And, you know, I played college ball in Dallas where it's super windy. And Mickey, that was the first thing he said to me. He said, hey, this is Mickey Loomis. How'd you like to punt in a dome for the rest of your career? And I thought that sounds pretty good. And so it was the start of a magical 12 years. I wouldn't change any bit of it. It was just, I can't say enough about the organization and how grateful I was to be a part of it.
You know, it is a journey for sure. We're talking with Thomas Morstead here on the Game Time podcast. And Thomas, on March 4th, 2021, after being a fixture with the Saints for a dozen seasons, you were let go to save the team $2.5 million in cap space. Hey, look, football is a hard business. We all know that. And it can be cold-hearted. So how did you get the bad news and how did you break it to your family and friends?
I was actually on a parent conference with my wife on Zoom and I got a call from Coach Payton. And I just walked out, took the call and came back in and had to tell my, you know, we stuck out the rest of the parent-teacher conference for another 15 minutes. And then I told my wife that I'd been released. It was really, really difficult. And, you know, it's just one of the realities of the job. You know, at some point it's going to end. And, you know, it this sounds silly, but it almost felt like somebody died. That's how tough it was on us. We still live there full time. It's our home. And it was just it was a tough time for sure.
Yeah, I know you were building your dream home in New Orleans at the time. And among those who had called you was a buddy of mine by the name of Morton Anderson, the Hall of Fame kicker that he is.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering what his message to you was.
So he called me 2 days after, and we played for the same coach, a guy by the name of Frank Gans Sr. So we have that bond. And he just, I remember I answered the phone. I was at Will Lutz's bachelor party out in Florida, having, you know, a good time. And he just said, "My good man, I just want to congratulate you on a Hall of Fame Saints career." He said, "You know, I had a 13-year career in New Orleans and got released by the Saints, and I knew I was not done. And I know that you're not done, and I can't wait to see how you rebound and you will be rejuvenated because I know you have such a love for the game." And it was just to get such an encouraging message from a guy that's actually been through a similar type of experience that went on to have a whole nother career after that.
Yep.
It was an amazing gesture from him, and I'll never forget it.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's this game is, it can be cruel and it can be fulfilling at the same time, which is weird. And I know that you ended up punting for the Jets for a little bit. You ended up punting for Atlanta. I'm just wondering, going back to New Orleans in an Atlanta Falcons uniform, much like Morton Anderson did, what was that like for you?
It was tough. You know, I only got one game in against the Saints, and it was in Atlanta. And, you know, when you know 80% of the team still, that was but it was also kind of the end or the final step in the grieving process. You know, the people in the suits upstairs, they were down on the field to come give me a hug. I think everybody was happy that I'd landed on my feet and that I'd gotten healthy and validated that I was still a good player in this league. And I felt that from players, from coaches. And I just feel really fortunate to not have a feeling of resentment towards the organization or to anybody in the building, because I don't think that's the norm. I think most people leave with a bad taste in their mouth. And I just had a spirit of gratitude. And I just am really grateful for that, because I know it's not the norm.
You know, it's great to hear you say that, because you're right. It is not the norm. All right, we're going to be right back with Thomas Morstead to discuss two of the most famous kicks in modern NFL history.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites.
So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor. Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app.
Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.
Welcome back, everyone. Many of us think about punting in terms of distance, hang time, and accuracy. Thomas Morstead says it's all about winning the play. So, Thomas, how would you explain your concept of winning the play?
I just think it's about, you know, you obviously statistically you keep up with where you stand, whether it's your gross punt average or your net punt average or, you know, inside the 10s, inside the 20s. But to me, it's about winning plays. Knowing the situation in the game, what can't happen is so important to know what can't happen at a certain juncture of the game. Situational awareness, all those things. And I learned a lot of that from Coach Payton, honestly. And so you try not to get bent out of shape about having a low average for a game or for a series of time, whether it's, you know, maybe a month stretch. You just try to win each play as it comes and you just focus on that. And I think if you can do that, you give yourself the best chance to have the best impact for your team.
All right, let's talk about two of these kicks that you've had. And one I feel like I was a part of because prior to Super Bowl 44, I met with Coach Payton as I was broadcasting the game for Westwood One. And he said, you know, just be aware. We're going to do things.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay, what kind of things are you going to do? And lo and behold, you guys are down 10-6 at halftime against Peyton Manning and the Colts, of course. And then Sean Payton opts to open the second half by having you attempt a surprise onside kick. Now, you're a rookie, and I have to ask you, how confident were you that it would work, and how terrified were you if it didn't work?
Well, those are the two, that's the yin and the yang of the emotions I felt. You know, the halftime is about three times as long at the halftime of the Super Bowl because they've got the whole show. And he came in right at the beginning of halftime and said we were running this. And I was mortified. I never really thought we would do it. And I just had such a negative energy about it. And at some point, I just said, you know what? I got to get all this out of my system. So I started trying to think of every negative repercussion of this not working. And I kind of have like a psychological examination of myself. Went through, let everything negative pour out, and I was pacing around the locker room, probably 10 minutes left before we're heading out. And I had that, speaking of Frank Gann Sr., I had a picture of him off my locker because he had passed away the day after I got drafted. And he used to always say that the more aggressive team was normally the team that won. And I thought, well, this is pretty effing aggressive. And it was the first time I relaxed and took a breath, and it made me feel, I felt positive about it. And then I thought, you know, every time Coach called me up at surprise, he'd just call me up in the middle of practice and say, I want the kickoff team out here now. We're running ambush. And every single time he called me up to do it, I hit it how I wanted. And then all of a sudden I started feeling good. I said, you know, if we make this play, this could be the thing that changes the game for us. And then by the time I went out and started warming up for halftime, before the second half kickoff, I was very confident and the adrenaline was coursing through my veins. And the only thing that stinks about it is you can't practice it before you do it. So I'm out here trying to hit balls out the back of the end zone and burn some energy off. And by the time we got to that point, I was very confident. And the last thing that was said to me before I went on the field, John Carney, our kicker turned coach that year, he would always tell me to hit 10%. And he grabbed me by the helmet as I walked out on the field. And he said, Timo, 1%, because he knew I was gassed up. And thank God we did it. It was a great play for us. And it certainly felt like we were winning. It was inevitable that we were going to win the game after that play.
You know, you certainly won that play. You obviously go on and win the Super Bowl 31-17 your rookie year. It's a game-changing play. It's a life-changing play, isn't it?
It certainly is. You know, being a part of a championship team, unless you've experienced it at this highest level, you walk with a different confidence for the rest of your life in every other area of your life. You know, you did something as a group that no one can ever take away from you. And for me personally, as a specialist, you know, so much of the game is mental, and being able to bring yourself back to that moment in times of doubt when you're not believing in yourself or you're going through something, and you can say, I have a history of getting it done when it matters most. Being able to say that to yourself and actually believe that has been a big thing for me in my career. And so I'm very grateful for that, not just for that moment, for that season, but for the rest of my career. It's been a wonderful thing.
Yeah, it has been a wonderful thing. Now, I want to take you to another kick. Now, I wish you had done this when you were with the Jets. Now, I played with the Jets in 1994. We lost a game to the Dolphins, and that game went down as the spike game. That's what it's known around here in these New York parts, the spike game.
Yep.
And everybody looks at me like, what about the spike game? Now, when you played for the Jets, if you would have done what you did with the Dolphins earlier this year, it would have been amazing. Now, you actually punted out of your end zone, and you know what I'm talking about, and you hit the punt into the butt of Trent Sherfield, your teammate there, and it became known as the butt punt. And if you would have done that here with the Jets, it would have been synonymous with the butt fumble that Mark Sanchez experienced on a Thanksgiving Day game against the New England Patriots. Did you ever hear from Mark Sanchez about that? And number two, like, what did that feel like when that thing happened?
Yeah, Mark tweeted at me after the game saying to stay out of his lane, which is really funny. You know, it was such a unique thing. We were backed up on the 1-inch line, and you know, it was one of those where, do you go for it? Do you go for the punt, or do you take the safety? We were protecting a 4-point lead. So it's either punt out the back of your end zone and they need a touchdown, or you take the safety and you punt from the 20 on a kickoff, and you're now only protecting a 2-point lead. So they only need a field goal. So, you know, who knows what would have happened if we'd have done something different. All I know is this: I'm so glad that ball landed out the back of the end zone as opposed to being caught by them for a touchdown. And then, you know what? The very next play, we went out there as a kickoff team and we put that snap behind us, and I hit a ball, I think it was 74 yards, that was caught at the 6 on the punt after safety, and we pinned them at maybe the 20 or 22, and they never got in the field goal range, and we won the game. So as Coach likes to say, I felt like that was competitive greatness by myself and by the rest of the kickoff team, that we were able to, you know, flip the field in such a massive way with very little time left. So I'm glad it made it a little easier to swallow the play, the fact that we bounced back and made the big play right after it.
You know, Thomas, I love the way you look at things. Somehow you turned the butt punt into a safety that ended up winning the game because of your 74-yard punt on the kickoff after a safety, which is awesome. I love it. The only thing you could do is embrace it, kind of like Mark Sanchez has done with the butt fumble.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's like being insecure about something in the locker room. The more insecure you are, the more people are going to poke at it. So you just got to accept it and move on, you know?
Right, exactly. All right, Thomas, let's briefly discuss another big playoff game you were involved in. Now, the Saints' 2017 season ended in stunning fashion, to say the least, when Minnesota's Stephon Diggs caught a 61-yard walk-off touchdown. Under a then-existing NFL rule, the teams were required to line up for a meaningless point after try. Now, even though you were injured, making a touchdown-saving tackle earlier in that game, you were one of only 8 Saints who returned to the field.
Well, look, it was kind of dumb luck that I was the first one out there. I hung out on that field after the game for a long time because I knew the rule. I knew that we had to do an extra point, and I was just hanging out there. And at some point, there was no one left on the field. So I finally started walking off the field. I guess we're not doing it. And right as I got in the locker room, the referees were running out with the football, and half the guys were in there. You know, they were already in their towels. They'd taken all their gear off, and guys were like, I'm not going back out there. And they said, you know, they were just saying, hey, we need 11 guys. And so I just turned back around and went back out there. I knew they were going to take a knee. I certainly didn't know that it would get all the, you know, fanfare and notoriety that it got. So anyways, yeah, I just went out there and I lined up at D tackle, and Case Keenum's a buddy of mine. And he said, Thomas, we're going to take a knee. I said, you better, because I do not play D line, obviously. So yeah, the play happened, and then somebody went on Reddit and just said, hey, they were inspired by me getting hurt, playing through it, coming back out, showing good sportsmanship, and said, hey, Thomas has a charity. If you want to donate, you can do that. And within a few hours, it was up to like $5,000. And I just acknowledged it on social media the next day and said, hey, I really appreciate all the funds. We'll donate this back to a Minnesota Children's Hospital or something like that. Like, I didn't feel like the money should come down to New Orleans from all these Vikings fans. And then as soon as I did that, it blew up and we raised over $300,000.
Wow.
It was unbelievable. I think a lot of Vikings fans were hoping for some good mojo because they were in the NFC Championship game. And, yeah. And 2 weeks later, if they had won, they'd have been in the Super Bowl. So I think they were trying to get some good karma going as well. So it was a unique thing that happened and something I'll never forget.
Yeah, you know, I mean, NFL fans in general could be harsh at times, but they can be giving at times. And when they do something like that, much like the Bills Mafia up in Buffalo, and I'm sure down in New Orleans you have fans down there that support your charitable endeavors. So tell me, what is What You Give Will Grow Foundation, and why did you give it that name?
Again, going back to Frank Gans, that was one of his sayings, what you give will grow, and what you keep, you lose. And it just always had an impact on me. You know, down in New Orleans, just like a lot of these major cities, there's lots of areas of need and lots of things that need highlighting in these cities. And the Saints do such a good job. Miss Alicia Lish Sheridan down there, she's the bomb. She gets guys lined up for school visits and, you know, doing other things in the community where there's a need. And they really do a good job of showing you all the different areas of need so that you can see what you may want to focus on or something that really is pulling on you. And so I was able to do a lot of that as a young player and was able to start a foundation. And COVID has really derailed a lot of what we did for a number of reasons, because we do a lot of things with kids in the hospital. So fundraising was tough with COVID, and doing things with immunocompromised kids was tough. So we've kind of been derailed the past few years, but it's like anything. When you give of your time, you give of your resources, you get so much out of it personally. It's been great for me and my wife and our kids to experience and just, you know, be a small little help in the community you live in. It's a really cool thing to do.
You know, well said. And we were talking about how you're a 24/7 athlete, and I know nutrition is a big part of who you are as a player and one of the reasons why you're successful. And there's also a little company that you found called Main Squeeze Juice Company. How did this first come to your attention and later become part of your business portfolio?
It was a former teammate of mine, Marcus Colston, the Quiet Storm. He was our number one receiver for a decade in New Orleans. And when I saw that he had invested in this company, and the first store opened up 5 minutes from my house, so I started going, and then I start checking my credit card receipt at the end of every month, realizing how much I was spending. And I called a meeting with the CEO, and I don't think they were looking for any help, and I wasn't looking to invest. I was more just kind of curious to see if I could get some sort of product deal. And after we met, I think we both kind of looked at each other like, you know, we could be of value to each other. And so I bought into a bit of the business and have kind of let's call it a brand ambassador for the city of New Orleans and the surrounding areas. And now the company has continued to expand, and we're in a bunch of different states with getting close to 100 locations now. So it's really been a cool thing. It's allowed me to not have much responsibility, have a little skin in the game, and learn some of the business stuff passively, and also being a part of some of their efforts to expand their brand. So it's been a really cool experience for me. And, you know, I wouldn't have done it had it been any other type of business that I wasn't really interested in. It was more from the standpoint, it's a personal lifestyle thing for me. And I'm all into my wellness and all those little, especially as you get older, every little bit helps. That cold tub, the good nutrition, the sleep, all the bits and pieces, you got to have it all. And so it's right up my alley.
You know, and your former teammate, Marcus Colston, where did he go to school, his college?
Hofstra.
And who used to practice at Hofstra with their pro days and everything? It used to be us, the New York Jets.
Okay.
So I know Marcus from his days back at Hofstra.
Very
so
cool.
There you go. Small world, Thomas. I appreciate you joining me today. It was a great interview. I'm Boomer Esiason. I'll see you again real soon right here on Game Time with former Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback star Cordell Stewart.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app. Thanks to Republic Records. This is a national contest.